this episode of Adventures in Being Gifted.
Structurally, school systems are kind of broken right now. And I think the first thing I would get rid of is like the industrial model of what schools look like. 7 or 8 classes a day, 40 minutes of, and I'm talking secondary mostly. Just thinking in terms of like blocks of time where students have dedicated time with truly interdisciplinary learning, actually having maybe teachers of different content areas co-teaching different interdisciplinary blocks where they're doing real world problem solving and school like skills projects, maybe working with community members or businesses. Kids all learn at different paces and in different ways. And I think the faster schools acknowledge those kinds of things, the better equipped they'll be for, you know, whatever the world's going to look like in the next 10 to 20 years.
That and a whole lot more coming up.
All right, welcome everybody. We are so excited for this episode today, although it can be a bit controversial. It is involving grades and assessments. And our guest today is putting her experiences and her research to the test to see if do we really need these two things in our school systems.
That's right. And when you hear the words going gradeless or gradeless classrooms, I think everybody kind of like stops in their tracks. And I think this is really worth a listen. If you are a parent, if you are a student or a teacher, this is a great way to get some real practical ways. I definitely recommend picking up her book, and we will share that in the episode. Not just book, but books, and checking her out to see what you might be able to do to implement some more authentic ways to really find out what students know and engaging them in very meaningful ways that gets them excited. And they are like in, they're plugged in, they own it. They're excited. They want to be a part of what's happening in these types of classrooms.
All right. So let's dive right in.
Hello, everyone. Today we are talking with Star Sackstein, who is best known as the authority on assessment and no grades classrooms. She has been in education for over 20 years, has written many books, and is currently the COO of Mastery Portfolio and an educational consultant.
We are so looking forward to discussing why we should consider giving up grades and assessment reform. Welcome to Adventures in Being Gifted, Star.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you about the topic.
Well, we want to know, since you've been an educator for 20 years, just a little bit about your story and kind of how you've been led to your kind of known label as being an advocate for going gradeless.
So, I mean, I think I started like most folks, like the first year zero to five, I pretty much did teaching the way teaching was done to me. So it was pretty teacher-centered. And I would say that the biggest shift happened when I had my son. And in his school, they did standards-based grading. And I think at that time, I was really grappling with just learning more about different kinds of assessments. I had started teaching in New York City public schools, and I worked with a largely minority and low-income population, and traditional education really wasn't working for them. And I wanted to see them be successful. So as more time went on, I started reading a lot of books, getting very involved. I had read Alfie Kohn's work and Ken O'Connor in particular, who had this book called 15 Fixes for Broken Grades. And I think my level of frustration at that time was so high, and I was trying to be equitable in the way that my students had opportunities to show what they know in a variety of different ways. And as an English teacher, I think there was a fair amount of flexibility in the way that I could do that. And also, I taught journalism and English most of my time when I was teaching high school. And just a lot of different student-centered things were happening in my newspaper classes, my journalism classes. And I had crossover there a bit with a bunch of my students who were in both my journalism classes and my AP English class. And, you know, I was just... It was a lot of sort of trying things out. And then national board certification happened for me as well. And when I did that and had to watch myself teach and reflect on that practice, that metacognitive element of thinking about the way that I make decisions, the processing that was going on there, sort of helped me to understand how I could use that in my own classroom to better understand the way my students thought. And in doing that, the level of understanding I had about them was far greater than any assessment I ever put in front of them. So that's sort of where the seeds of it all started. And, you know, then sort of years of trial and error until I found a method that worked.
So let's define exactly what does it mean to go gradeless and assessment reform for all of our listeners.
Sure. So There's actually a spectrum when we talk about going gradeless. The way that I was doing it in my classroom was that grades were basically delayed. No grade got put on student work. It was all feedback. And then I would do assessment conferences with my students using their portfolio of work. And then we would discuss a grade together that would have to go on the report card. Because when I was working inside of New York City Public Schools, they required report card grades, and I was the only person in my school doing this. So I needed to find a way to go from nothing to something on the report card. So it was more of a mastery approach. We had rubrics, success criteria, and then a mastery scale, and the students had the opportunity to then convert their level of understanding into a score that would go on their report card. Some people I know use no grades at all and have the luxury of just being able to give narrative feedback on a report card. And then you have some folks like me who have full standards-based report cards where they have competency get assessed with a 1-4 scale or with mastery language instead, if not using a 1-4, using some, you know, mastery proficiency approaching language to talk about specific student learning in a variety of areas.
As you were describing that progression of kind of your own learning and your own awareness, were you making these rubrics like with the students, and was that happening kind of like naturally or grassroots? Tell us a little bit about that, like even from like the first moment of you doing it, you know, because you kind of had to have something to what was authentic and meaningful with that rapport you already had with your students to really reflect their ability and their learning.
Sure. So at first, I think I started building the rubrics myself until I felt like I could teach it to my students how to do it. And then from there, I moved away from a 4-point rubric because honestly, I didn't find it terribly effective. I moved to a single point rubric, and then we would co-construct from the single point rubric, which was directly aligned with, at the time, Common Core standards, which is what my school was using. And the students would help me co-construct success criteria, which was like the student-facing language and the specific outcomes that aligned with the particular standards. Like, what would it look like in this particular assessment? And we would have those conversations before they started to do the learning so that they went into the learning with clarity about expectations and they were able to really have choice and voice in not only what success looked like, but how they demonstrated it. So the differentiation wasn't just like a text level differentiation. It was also product and process level differentiation, depending on how they wanted to approach the projects that we were doing. Because as these progressions sort of happened, I moved away from traditional assessment and moved more toward a project-based paradigm where in class they were working collaboratively in these projects, and then they demonstrate individual learning on written assessments that came after. So they had time to practice the concepts and the content and the different skills with partners, and then they would be assessed on their independent work after the fact.
So I'm still like hearing the word assessment. So what would those end of the unit assessments look like?
So I wouldn't necessarily, they were, so if they're using the projects for the learning and we're using a workshop model where, you know, there are mini lessons from time to time, sometimes whole group, sometimes small group based on, you know, what folks need during those specific times. Or, and then at the end of that project, like let's say we were doing a project on poetry, and during that poetry unit where they had to create tutorials, for example, that was one of the projects that they would do where different poetic terms and devices were divvied up to students. Then they would create these tutorials. We would do a gallery walk in class with these videos that they created. And then every student in the class would select a poem they wanted to do a poetry analysis paper about. And they would demonstrate their learning from the tutorials through an analysis paper.
As this has been your experiences, and this is like true life stories and situations, if you could have a magic wand, what would a dream school or school system look like for you?
Man, yeah. So I think they're like structurally, school systems are kind of broken right now. And I think the first thing I would get rid of is like the industrial model of what schools look like. You know, this 7 or 8 classes a day, 40 minutes of, and I'm talking secondary mostly because that's where I spent my time. Like just thinking in terms of like blocks of time where students have dedicated time with truly interdisciplinary learning so that they're not sitting in these very specific content standalones and often having all of this transfer challenge, but actually having maybe teachers of different content areas co-teaching different interdisciplinary blocks where they're doing real world problem solving and school like skills projects, maybe working with community members or businesses, or depending on what path they take, so they have some ownership over what content they're really interested in. At, you know, with an overlay of like, this is the expected outcomes for graduation. And I think graduation requirements need to be reassessed as well. I think we need to get rid of seat time requirements. I think that kids all learn at different paces and in different ways. And I think the faster schools acknowledge those kinds of things, the better equipped they'll be for, you know, whatever the world's going to look like in the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, this is exciting for us. We love to kind of hypothesize like this and dream. And it makes me think about the way that apprenticeships used to happen.
Yes.
And even bringing in real world, you know, people who are in their career and they can coach them. My son, who is a senior in high school, just experienced last year in one of his economics classes, the Shark Tank, and his team actually won their whole whatever competition. And so, you know, they had real business people sitting in the audience. And then we kind of took that model for our third graders, and we were trying to teach them about the creativity elements. And we really put them in their own little Shark Tank here in our little program. So it was just fun to be able to kind of give them a real world kind of activity or model like the Shark Tank, and then know that high schoolers were doing it at the same time across the street from our building. So it's something that we completely agree with, and we try it out with our own third graders.
I think that's amazing. Entrepreneurship, there's so much to unpack that kids can, and they could really like, it's exciting to have an idea about something and then try to make it marketable, like try to make it something people could use. In my son's gifted program, when he was in sixth grade, they had the invention convention at the end of that school year where, you know, they spent half a year building a product or something they felt would help the community. And then it would be on display in the library for the invention convention. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Did anything come of that? Like, did any new inventions like actually get picked up?
I don't think so in his year, but I'm fairly certain that other kids have had like patentable ideas. And I know that the teacher that worked with that program also did something with like limbs. Like they ended up getting like a 3D printer and were helping to make limbs for kids were like amputees. Yeah, it's, I don't know.
I
think kids are so empathetic. And like they think about things in a way I think adults often lose sight of. So when we give kids that power and opportunity to really have the agency to let their creativity grow into something more than just an idea, I think that's like the best thing we can do for them.
All right. So thinking of going gradeless and all these exceptional ideas that you kind of explained from your experiences, in a regular school, like the one, you know, we work in every day, what are some practical examples of how going gradeless works that we could offer some of our teachers?
Sure. So first of all, clarity is at the heart of everything. So shifting the paradigm where, you know, you have your learning targets and then you're co-constructing success criteria with kids, you're giving them opportunities to show what they know in a variety of ways, and you're letting them set goals and use those goals as the things that propel their differentiation so that they've got some agency in all of this. And then teaching them about metacognition and reflection so that they can share their process and also talk about like how they felt they did, but not necessarily on the project alone, but how they were able to work on their own goals through the project or through the learning that was happening. I found that when students reflected on the assignments that they were given and I read their reflections first, that really helped me target the kind of feedback I gave all of them, which was a really practical way to differentiate, because sometimes when you have a large class, 34 in high school, and you want to really give them what they need, it's sometimes really hard to know everything that all of them need. And trying to differentiate instruction for that many kids on a day-to-day basis on like a whole class approach is never going to meet the needs of every single kid in that room. So thinking about doing it through the feedback, through their processing, and through the products that they develop are a lot of nice ways that you could really give them voice and choice in the classroom, which is essentially what a gradeless classroom is all about. We don't want to label their learning with numbers and really disrupt their sense of their own learner identities, which is what grading essentially does to kids. It makes them think they are or are not a certain kind of learner based on the discretion of individual teachers at different times in their learning, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's definitely making me think about how grades affect the way we see ourselves, and whether that is in a positive light or a negative light or unintentionally negative, almost like in your TED talk, what you shared about yourself when you were in high school. And, you know, sometimes you go way on one end where you might be addicted to, you know, those high grades or perfect grades. Or we had a conversation yesterday with one of our colleagues. When you have a gradeless class, how do you maintain that motivation? Because I think some of those students, the older they get, start to realize, oh, this is not for a grade. I'm not getting a grade. Therefore, I'm not going to put in as much effort or care or chutzpah, you know, what have you. Uh-huh. And how do you kind of work through that?
So it's really all about the culture of learning you cultivate in that space. And it takes a fair amount of time to shift them away from this very transactional approach to learning, where it's really more compliance-based when you're worried more about the grade than you are about the learning. So we have to go out of our way to put the real focus on what matters. And we could do that by helping, you know, being co-creators with the students on what curriculum gets taught in class and how it gets taught, allowing them to set goals so that they get to choose when they're addressing different things that need to be learned over the course of a year. And really, the motivation becomes intrinsic when they see themselves meeting the goals and seeing more positive feedback. On my YouTube channel, I have a student, there's a video of an end of year conference with one of my students. And when you listen to her talk about her own learning, like the level of pride she has in her growth over time, that's really what the focus has to be. Not that I increased from a C to an A, because that's fairly arbitrary, but that I've developed very specific skills that I can articulate to you and then demonstrate through my understanding and evidence that I am able to do those things. And then also advocate for where I still need help, because I'm still struggling with a couple of the skills that we may have worked on that year. So we're really giving kids this vocabulary to talk about themselves as learners so that they could better communicate where they're doing well and where they need continued support.
And it also seems like they're not so afraid to lose whatever title that they were maybe holding on to. It may be the rapport that you've had and the pieces that you have listed, like the co-creation, the choice, the feedback piece, the talking, and that just creates a safe place for them that they can honestly share, like, oh yeah, I'm still needing to improve on blankety blank. And then
absolutely,
I can identify my strengths, you know? And I think that that does happen over the course of a class or a school year, you know, with a teacher that you really do trust and believes that they like you as a student.
And I think to that end, sorry.
No, you're good.
I was going to say, I think to that end as well, though, I think a teacher has to demonstrate that they too are a learner. And I think that that's really one of the things that cultivated that level of trust in my classroom. I was always very transparent with my students. So when I didn't have an answer, but towards the end of my time in the classroom, I felt less afraid about just owning the fact that I didn't know. And it became an opportunity for us to figure it out together. Instead of, like, at the beginning of my career, like, I was absolutely terrified about, like, not knowing answers. It almost felt like being caught not knowing something. And the length that I would have gone to at the beginning of my career to just sound like an authority, even if I wasn't one, was ridiculous. And the more I let go of that need to be the only expert in the space, the more it became a true learning environment where I was a learner with them and not just, you know, the person in the room with the degree telling them what they had to know.
Yeah. And back to kind of what both of you were saying, I feel like students get pockets of this sometimes where some teachers are very much embracing this style. And I truly feel like you have a relationship like no other when you do this sort of assessment with students and really make the learning become a whole, like, teacher-student thing and not just the student is the learning.
Safe.
And safe.
You know, it's not a scary thing. It's not like they're like, what grade are you going to give me? You know, it's like, you're talking through it.
Yeah. But to really change the mindset of teachers in an entire school or an entire district is a whole nother thing. I think, I just am so curious about how can we do this? So in a school system where you have maybe been working with, how have you successfully, you know, kind of had this evolution happen?
So, I mean, it takes really good leadership, like really, really good instructional leadership to support teachers in this paradigm. And I think a lot of times some of the challenges are that you get a leader who's really excited about an idea like this, and they don't necessarily take the time to slow down and understand that implementation of a shift like this really does take a fair amount of time. And if you're going to do it well, and we, at my company, we counsel schools that you kind of have to go slow to go fast with a change like this, because you get one opportunity probably in a decade, because teachers have long memories. And if it fails because you didn't implement it like well, the failure is in the implementation, not in the idea. I think almost every teacher wants to do right by kids. You don't go into this profession because you love giving grades and you love being powerful in that space. You truly want to see kids be successful. So I think that if we slow down long enough, we do a needs assessment of where the teachers are in their own pedagogy right now. We're really thoughtful about the assets that the community already bring to the table. And then you have a truly differentiated approach to the implementation, so that maybe you have some folks piloting things a little earlier than other people who might need some more support pedagogically. And then, you know, kind of layering it over time. So like maybe the first thing you really work on is building a culture of reflection in the school, because that's something you could do without changing much. It's just, you know, implementing that one piece. The second thing you could do is really have a strong understanding of the formative assessment process and stop grading the things that you're calling formative work, because if it's truly practice, it shouldn't be graded. And kids should be getting really robust feedback throughout that process, more peer feedback in that cycle as well. And then as you're layering all of these things in, the very last thing you talk about is your grading system. Because now you've put all of these really sound pedagogical practices in place, and now you have better aligned assessments. Maybe you have your common formatives as well as common summatives if you're going to be doing it that way. And you make sure that you have this backward plan of, you know, these are the content and skill standards that we really need to be assessing. All of these assessments are truly aligned to those things. And then we backward plan for how we could bring students into that process so that they could be successful. And then at the end, you know, if you're building a really robust portfolio system also, then that idea of like a final exam is also not as necessary, because you have an entire profile of work that shows student learning and progress over an entire year. And you give kids the ownership to show that progress, tell that story, the journey of their learning over the course of a year. And you put that process in place anywhere from, you know, 3 to 5 years, not 6 months. 6 months isn't going to do well for anyone, really. And you don't have 20 other initiatives going on at the same time.
Bingo. Yeah. So with that being said, because that was a lot of great information, if a teacher is listening and they really want to dive in, out of all of your books, which one would you recommend they pick up first to kind of start really practicing the gradeless classroom?
So Hacking Assessment. I just came out with the second edition of Hacking Assessment. And I would say that's probably the best starter book. I don't know if you're familiar with the Hack Learning series, but it's very teacher friendly, very practical. It spends less time on, like, there is why in there, but it's mostly how. And it talks about everything from how you build rapport in the classroom straight through to getting rid of a grade book, straight through to building portfolio systems in schools. And then if you're a teacher who works with younger students where social emotional learning is also really important, assessing with respect would be my other top recommendation, because that book is all about the overlay of social emotional learning and assessment.
Okay, that's good advice. Any advice for administrators who are listening? Where would they begin? Same place?
So, well, the second edition of Hacking Assessment, I actually deliberately added leadership tips in it, because a lot of individual teachers have written to me over the years and said, you know, what do I tell my administrator when I want to do this? What resources should I provide for them? I would say that if you have teachers who want to do this work, support them. Make sure you're educating your community. Parents will have a lot of questions. So make sure you're ready to support them when parents have questions as a starting point. And if they're taking an interest, take an interest with them and learn together as a group, because this isn't the kind of shift that happens with a single teacher if you want it to really have legs. It's got to happen in a whole space, not just, I did it in one classroom. I had great success with my students. Unfortunately, I was a 11th and 12th grade teacher. They came to me and I had a lot of undoing to do before I got to where we get. If I had colleagues who were doing it much younger, I probably could have gone much, much, much deeper with them.
All right, we are going to start to wrap up here, but is there something that you wished we asked you, but we haven't yet, that you'd like our listeners to hear?
I just think I wish that teachers could sometimes divorce their own experiences in school and be open to an alternative approach. I think a lot of times people hear no grades and they make a lot of assumptions about what that means, and that it's probably less rigorous, or somehow not doing it the traditional way makes it less, I don't even know the word I want to use, maybe less potent in some way. And I would argue that these alternative assessments are really a lot more rigorous and creative, and there are ways to build in a lot of different skills into those environments. So I guess the other thing I would say is just, you have to be okay struggling in the beginning, because it's not an easy shift, and it will be a struggle, and not every project's going to be a winner. And you know, you are going to get pushback. And so you're going to need to be able to build up your arsenal of how to cope with that when it's happening.
Yeah. I think that's wise words, because I think we're, you know, coming off of the pandemic and we're feeling like we're back to normal, quote unquote, but yet we're not. And there's all these different pieces and layers, like you've said, on top of just trying to get better at our practice. And I think that it's important to kind of give ourselves grace as we're learning something new, or at least trying to do what is ultimately best for these kids. And I'm curious if your second edition of Hacking Assessment has any kind of forethought or insight from the pandemic and all of our online learning and the shutdown and everything like that.
Actually, both of the books that I suggested do. There's definitely more of an equity lean in both of them as well. Like, I think I didn't necessarily recognize the level of shift in my own practice. I am very comfortable talking about the biases that I've worked through and continuing to work through. And that's in there too, just like how that pokes its head through things, as well as the fact that you really can't look at learning the same way after what we experienced, and the level of things that kind of shook out over the last few years, we can't pretend that they don't exist. So, I mean, it is very, there are a lot of references to the pandemic in them. And I also really try to tap into the knowledge and resources of folks across a broad range of education. So it's not just coming out of my English classroom anymore. There's, you know, K through higher ed examples, there are leadership examples, there are every single content area examples. And then the appendix just has tons of stuff that so many brilliant people were generous enough to share. So, I mean, there's a lot of resources in it.
That is wonderful. Yeah, we so appreciate that, because it's still something, at least here in the Midwest, that we're still trying to piece together, and some people are willing to talk about it and some people aren't. And it's just something I do think we need to put out there and have these conversations. So we are really excited to pick up that second edition and find out what you are talking about with other experts across the country and probably the globe. So that's super helpful. One last question. How are you seeing that students are changing? I know that this is another common conversation that's happening at lunches with teachers or in the hallways. In what ways are you seeing students changing?
I think students have an innate curiosity that they've always had, but because they have access to so much more technology now, they're able to seek out answers they're not necessarily getting in schools. I also think that students, it's one of two ways. I think that there's a lot more anxiety in kids now as well. So you have this sort of dichotomy of you have some kids who totally excelled through the pandemic. My son was actually one of them. He was fully virtual, and that was good for him. He liked learning at his own pace. He liked being at home. And then other kids socially, that was just not great for. So we just, I think, as cliche as it sounds, like, relationships are at the heart of all the cultures of learning we create, and knowing our kids really, really well and not to make assumptions about who they are and what they know until we really have a good sense of who they are, so we could make really sound decisions based on what we learn.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Well, thank you so much, Star, for being a part of our episode today. And we are just thrilled to hear the knowledge that you've gained and learned through and worked through yourself. And this is going to be a huge resource for our listeners. So thank you for being here today with us.
Thanks so much. I'm eager to hear what everybody thinks.
All right. As we all know, there is so much change going on with our students these days, and our traditional ways of doing school just don't seem to be working. And Star really has some great answers.
Yeah. And hearing, you know, her say things like, gosh, our school system is broken, it really just kind of opens your eyes and makes you want to listen and to see what is it that we've done for so long and that we're so used to and we're so ingrained with is maybe not what's best for students and kids.
That's right. And I think the cool thing that she said is clarity is at the heart of this all, and the learning targets that she is working on and setting, and even in her books that she has available, it really helps us to understand this is not just all loosey-goosey. This is really meaningful ways to help students get over those anxieties that they have in terms of tests or quizzes or things that just don't really connect in meaningful ways, but yet using rubrics and different ways to create, like, tutorials for other classmates is a way to actually assess what they know.
And to see their learning. So I would love to charge all of our teachers out there to make one small shift in the way you do things in your classroom. And as Star gave us so many great examples, and just to see what happens.
That's right. And to quote her, go slow to go fast.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of Adventures in Being Gifted. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite place to listen to podcasts to hear our next episode.
Share with your friends, colleagues, and anyone you think would benefit from Adventures in Being Gifted.
And we want to know what you want to hear more about. So let us know by tweeting us at beinggiftedpod or emailing us at adventuresinbeinggifted@gmail.com.
Until next time.